Okay, text number 8. We could be discussing these, there are more details to discuss, but we probably just get, you know, bogged down with them. To cover the basic points of each verse is enough. This is an important verse, also quoted by Krishna, also closely reflected in the Bhagavad Gita. Vedaham etam purusham mahantam aditya varnam tamasak parastat tameva viditva atimrityum eti nanyak panta vijate yanaya. I know this Supreme Person, more brilliant than the sun, beyond the world of ignorance. Simply by knowing him, one transcends death, and there is no other way to reach this perfection. Well, we've been describing how knowledge of the Supreme Person is the means for attaining liberation. So now, we, as a corollary, we state that there are no other effective means for becoming perfect other than knowing the Supreme Person. There's no other path for obtaining him. Ayana means path. And the sage Shvetashvatara is saying, this I understand. This I've realized, this fact. Or the sages are telling each other that there's no reason to doubt or argue about this. This is, we have to accept as an assumption. That this knowledge of this Supreme Person is the only effective means for gaining liberation. We all agree to this. When a person, according to the commentator here, when someone is thus grasp the essence of the truth, then that person is a tattvadarshi. He's enlightened. And he gets the power to encourage others to also enter into the path of self-realization. The sage speaking here is speaking authoritatively. He's just expressing his opinion, his belief, but there's authority, there's potency behind it, and that by that potency. Purusha Mahantam. Mahantam means great or big. So he's the supreme, the big, the greatest person. He's absolutely complete. He's everyone's soul. His color is like that of the sun. Which means to say his color, his transcendental qualities are spiritual. What is the fruit of realizing the Supreme Person? One becomes free. The fruit is that one becomes free from samsara, free from the cycle of birth and death. Then someone may raise a question. Aren't the ritual processes of offering sacrifices and doing pious works, aren't these also means, as taught in the Vedas and in the secondary Vedic literatures, aren't these also means to liberation? And the answer is no. There is no other means for crossing over the ocean of material existence. You can raise yourself to a higher mode of nature. You can go from the mode of ignorance to passion to goodness, but you can't get out of the whole cycle without knowing the Supreme Person. And knowing him means surrendering to him and becoming his devotee. Because sacrifices taught in the Vedas and ordinary pious works are all creations of ignorance of the material energy, and they're all kshayishnu, which means fallible. They're imperfect, and the benefits one earns by performing these pious works and sacrifices are temporary and are quickly used up. The pious credits one gets. But anyway, the Yajna Purusha, the person to whom sacrifices, for whom sacrifices are offered, He is the Supreme Person, the Super Soul. And what one should do is simply meditate on that Supreme Person. Then he'll attain actual perfection. Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Well, at this point, he's, you know, the visual activities are not being described favorably. He's saying there's no other process than this meditation. But the ritualistic image has been used, you know, in several places. Like, you know, meditating on finding the Lord in your heart is like building the sacrificial fire on the altar. You know, but that is obviously metaphorical. Well, because in the Satya Yuga, when this was probably spoken, that was the recommended process for devotional service. In Satya Yuga meditation, that this method of meditation is the equivalent of our Nam Sankirtana in Kali Yuga. So we have to understand in that context, in the time context. Specific process is taught because when, in the context of when it was spoken, that was the appropriate method for devotion, for bhakti yoga.
So he's saying that short meditation is better than
Yeah, and it's not just meditation. It's actual realization. Meditation as the means for actually knowing the Supreme Person. And that knowing is devotion. It's not just theoretical knowledge. Factual realization and actual surrender. You have to change of heart. One considers oneself simply the servant of the Supreme. And your service to Him may, in this case, be simply sitting there and meditating, but that's with an attitude of service, of worship. It's like I stand in front of the deity and just wave my hands, ring a bell and wave my hand, and, you know, stick of incense, a few things. It's trivial activity. You see, if I could stand in the street and wave my hands, people would think I'm crazy. Nobody's impressed by it. But I stand in front of the deity, it's worship. When I do it, if I do it, with a devotional consciousness, then it's pure devotion. So the sitting there and just, you know, staring at your nose and turning your mind inward becomes devotional service when it's done in the proper consciousness. The activity is only the external aspect, but that activity is accompanying the mood and the thoughts of devotion. So that's what Shvetashvatara is trying to teach here, not just the external aspects of meditation. He's not teaching meditation just for mind control or just for negating material activities. It's actually a process of devotional service. Not pure devotional service. It's mixed with motive of desire for liberation. There's a lot of emphasis on liberation. But it's liberation by becoming a devotee of the Supreme Person. Tatpara Yoni Mukta. Those who actually realize the Supreme Person, they became devoted to Him. That's been stated. And it'll be stated more emphatically later on. So he does say one should actually surrender to the Supreme Person, dedicate everything to Him. And if you're a sage who doesn't have any material activities, you know, doesn't have a job, doesn't even, you know, just sits around and meditates all day, then dedicate that meditation, make that your devotional service. Basically, he's talking to sages. So he's talking to them in terms of what they do and what they think about. They're going to meditate anyway. But he's trying to direct their meditation to, you know, on a devotional track.
So it's not the knowledge of the name itself?
No.
But he's saying that you need knowledge to become liberated, knowledge of your future.
Yes.
So he doesn't want to just say,
yes. Ramanujacharya, he would argue the way knowledge is being used in this context is the same thing as liberation. The word means In the bare sense, karma means working. In the full sense, karma means Vedic sacrifice. In the bare sense, jnana just means knowing something, having some consciousness of something that's correct. But in the fuller sense, jnana is devotion. Devotion is activity of the mind rather than activity of the external body. But the most valuable jnana, this one specific kind of jnana that's the most significant, is the activity of the mind when one is thinking of the Supreme Person. Devotion is a particular kind of jnana, and it is the ultimate sense of jnana. All other kinds of jnana are inferior.
Is there a jnana that people just want to know, the sense of knowledge of
themselves? Yes. And such a person is a jnani. The motivation is not pure. The person wants knowledge and for its own sake, so he can control and enjoy it. That's also a product of illusion. That's ignorance. Yes. Well, they're not just jnanis. Even from the very first verse, they announce that they want to know what's the real cause. They're not satisfied to have an encyclopedia of everything there is to know. They want to get down to the basic reality. Why are we suffering? The last line of the first verse. What makes us suffer? Why are we unhappy? This is a significant question. This is beginning of real knowledge. What is Brahman? They're not arguing, I don't know if I can accept an absolute truth. Well, maybe there isn't any absolute truth. They're beginning by accepting that the absolute truth is there. Now they want to know what is the real identity of that absolute truth. So that's beginning from impersonal, pure, just knowledge. But starting with a desire to go beyond that. At the very beginning of the Upanishad, the sages announce that they want to go beyond this. We all know there's an absolute truth. Now we want to know, what is that absolute truth actually? And how does that absolute truth have the power to even make us unhappy when we don't want to be unhappy? Okay? Yeah. All right. Okay, we're still on verse 8 here. And there's a few references from the... There's actually several. I'm only going to look at a few of them. References from the Vedanta Sutra here that apply to this verse. One is the Govinda Bhasha Baladeva Vidyabhushan in the first chapter, second part, Sutra number 20. So before he gives that sutra, he leads into it. He quotes from the Chandogya Upanishad, where it says, there is a purusha, a person, who is seen inside the sun, and he has a golden mustache and golden hair, and he's golden all over. Everything about him is gold color. And then a little later on, it says, a few verses later in the Chandogya Upanishad, another person who's seen inside the eye. And he's the same as the Rig Veda and the Sama Veda. So, the doubt is, who is this Purusha we're talking about here, who's seen inside the sun with gold mustache and gold hair? And who's this person inside the eye? Is it just a jiva who has become highly exalted because of his pious work and his cultivation of knowledge, some demigod or sage? Or is this actually that is seen in the sun and in the eye? Or is this the Paramatma we're talking about? Well, suggestion is made that because it's described that he has a body and other material features, this must be just a jiva. And the sutra replies to this suggestion. Antastad dharmopadeshat. Brahman is the one within the eye, within the sun, because his qualities are explicitly mentioned. The person who's inside both is the Paramatma, not the Jiva. Now Baladev is talking in his commentary. Why is that? Because he's described as explicitly having qualities that could only belong to the Supreme Person, not to a Jiva. In the same section of the Chandogya Upanishad, it said that he's apahata papma. He's not affected by any sins, that he has no death, no old age, no suffering, he's never hungry, he's never thirsty. All his desires are fulfilled. These are qualities not of any jiva, only of the Paramatma, the Supreme Person. And the argument you give that because he's said to have a body, he must be a jiva, that's not a valid argument. Because this verse, Vedaham etam purusham mahantam aditya varanam purushak tamasak parastat, which is originally spoken in the Rig Veda, in the Purusha Sukta. I didn't mention that. This verse comes directly from the Purusha Sukta of the Rig Veda. That verse describes the Purusha, the Supreme Purusha, as having a golden complexion and as being a person. So, on the evidence of a statement like this, Vedaham etam purusham mahantam aditya varnam, we have to accept that the Paramatma, the Supreme Person, also has a body. Just by having a body doesn't make him a jiva. Okay? Okay, there's one other argument, or one other discussion in the Vedanta Sutra 131. Again, Baladeva Vidyabhushan is talking in his commentary. Okay, there's a statement we hear in the Mundak Upanishad. Yasmindyao prithivi chantariksham otam manaksaha pranaischa sarvai tame vaikam janata atmanam anya vacho vimunchata amitasyaisha setuhu. Within him expand heaven, the earth and the sky in between, together with the mind and the senses. Know him alone to be the self. Cease speaking anything else, for he is the rampart of immortality. Now, there may be a doubt about this statement. Is this foundation of the earth and so on, is this material nature, pradhan, the original form of nature? Or is it some jiva? Is it a jiva, or is it Brahman, the absolute truth? Well, we might say that it's pradhan, it's material nature. Because it's said here that all transformations originate from that. And that's how it serves as the foundation of everything, because everything evolves from it by transformation. So that must be material nature that we're talking about here. Or someone else may argue, no, it's the jiva. Because the jiva is the enjoyer of material world, which is meant for his enjoyment. And so he's the foundation of the material world because it's built, it's created for his enjoyment. And also it said that in him are found the mind and the life air. So that must be the jiva. He's got the mind and the life air. They belong to him. So in answer to both of those suggestions, the sutra has to state, Dyu bhava yatanam swashabdat. No, he, Brahman, is the foundation of the sky and earth because of the unique description that pertains to him only. So the commentary says, it's Brahman who's this foundation, not material nature, not the jiva. Why? Because there's specific description, especially the words Amritasyaisha Setuhu. He is the rampart of immortality. He's the shelter in which immortality is found. That description uniquely applies only to Brahman, not to the jiva, not to material nature. Just like the rampart in the rice paddy field, the dike, keeps the field protected from too much flooding of water. Similarly, this absolute truth serves as the rampart of the ocean of samsara. It protects the living entities from the fear of drowning in the samsara and gives them liberation. He gives them liberation. And that's stated elsewhere in Shruti, namely the verse that says, Tameva viditva ati mrityumeti, this verse from Svetashvatara Upanishad. By knowing him alone, by that process, one transcends death. Not by knowing the jiva, not by knowing material nature. One more reference from the Vedanta Sutra, from the third chapter, fourth part, 33rd Sutra. Okay. The Vedic literature seems to be telling us that even after Baladeva Bhushan is saying this. The Vedas seem to tell us, Vedic literature seems to tell us that even after one has developed spiritual knowledge, he's still enjoined to continue ritualistic duties. Does that mean that knowledge and work both together are the cause of liberation? And the answer is no, according to the sutra. Sahakari Tvenacha. And that can be translated, Vedic rituals should be continued even after self-realization, simply as a secondary support for transcendental knowledge. Sahakari Tvena, as a secondary support. One should do his duties, his ritual duties, his work, as a supplement, support for his transcendental realization. Those ritual work is no way a cause of liberation. As it says in the Shretashvatara Upanishad, Tameva viditva ati mrityumeti nanyukpanta vidite yanaya. Only by knowing the absolute person, supreme person, can one transcend death. There's no other path leading to perfection. Okay, we can move on to the verse 9. Yasmat param na paramasti kinchid, yasmat na niyo na jayosti kaschid, viksha ivastabdo divitishchat yekas. Tenedam purnam purushena sarvam. There is no other supreme beyond him. No one is smaller or greater than him. He stands alone like a tree fixed in the sky. By that supreme person, this whole world becomes complete. This is a strange image of a tree in the middle of the sky. But that actually comes from the Rig Veda. There's one reference, I'll read that right below. Kinsvid vanam ka usa viksha asid yato dhyavipativi nitastakshu manishino manasa pichayitad yad adyad tishtad. Bhuvanani dharayan brahma vanam brahma sa viksha asid yato dhyavipativi nitastakshu manishino manasa pabhavini. Vo Bhamadya Tishtad Bhuvanani Dharayam. What is that forest? And what is that tree from which they fashioned the sky and the earth? O thoughtful ones, use your intelligence to ask this question. Ask about what acted as the foundation of the worlds, upholding them. Brahman is that forest, and Brahman is that tree from which they fashioned the sky and the earth. O wise ones, with all my intelligence, I say this to you. Brahman acts as the foundation of the world, upholding them. Hmm? No, it's Brahman himself, who's figuratively thought of as a tree. And there's an explanation here why he's standing in the middle of the sky by himself. Well, someone may ask, how is it that just by knowing knowledge of some person who has a gold body and a gold mustache and hair, how can one get liberation just by that kind of knowledge? The answer is that this Purusha is the Supreme Self, the Supreme Purifier. In the material world, he appears just like a tree. Like a tree doesn't bow down to anybody or anything. It stands upright, erect. The Supreme Person, in comparison to him, Brahma and all the demigods are like blades of grass. He's called in this verse, no, not in this verse, he's called Bhagawan in Purusha. He's called Purusha in this verse, Bhagawan in two verses later. And these words apply to him in their most literal, unrestricted senses. There are many people who could be, any person could be called Purusha. Any living being could be called Purusha. Then in a more restricted sense, it's supposed to mean a male, a man. And then it's understood ultimately to mean the Supreme Person. So Purusha, that word, applies in its most unrestricted sense, in its fullest sense, only to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the word Bhagavan also. Everything's dependent on him, including the jivas, because nothing is equal to or greater than him. And thus he's called Purushottama. Well, okay, someone may ask, he's Purushottama, then that means he's a jiva? He's a person, so he's a jiva? No. Yasman Naniyo. There's nothing smaller than him. The jiva is considered atomic in size, but he's even smaller than the jiva. He enters inside the heart of the jiva. He becomes even smaller than the jiva. Okay, then he's all pervading. Then he's the ether. He is the sky. That's the absolute. The answer is no. Na jayosti. There's nothing greater than him. The ether may be infinite, but he's more infinite than the ether. He's fixed like a tree. The Supreme Person. He's called Achyuta. Never falls. And where is he present? Where do you find him? In the sky. This tree is standing in the sky, meaning his personal transcendental abode. And he's alone, meaning that he's situated in his own spiritual identity, never covered by anything material. And just like a tree bears its fruits and flowers, similarly, countless universes full of variety expand from him. Tenedam purnam. Everything is pervaded by him. By his inconceivable energies, he pervades everything. Okay, I'll go to text 10. Tatoya rutarataram tararupamanamayam yaitad vidur amitas te bhavanti Atetare dukkam evapiyanti. The ultimate supreme beyond this world is devoid of material form and defects. Those who know him become immortal, but all others achieve only suffering. So he's called here arupam, he has no form. But his form is being described. Just two verses before, he said he had a golden complexion. So how can he be gold if he has no form, literally? So it has to be understood. He has no material form. And he has no defects. Again it says, Tato, Yarutarataram. What is superior to that? So that doesn't mean superior to the Supreme Person that we've been talking about. There is nothing superior to that Supreme Person. We just read. We just stated. Yasmat param na paramasti kinchit. In the last verse, previous verse, there's nothing greater than him. So how can we say, and beyond him, there's the real absolute truth? self-contradictory. So again, tato, superior to that means superior to this material world. It's stated here how he's the cause of all causes. And again it's said, again, those who know him become immortal. And added in the last line, everybody else achieves only suffering by all their endeavors, those who don't know him. Any questions so far? Okay. Verse 11. Sarvanana Shirogriva Sarva Buddha Guhashayaha Sarva Vyapi Sabhagavams Tasmat Sarvagata Shivaha. He's called Shiva again here. He possesses all faces, heads, and necks. He sits in the cave of every living being's heart. He is all-pervading in his impersonal feature, but is also the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the possessor of all opulences. Therefore, the auspicious Lord is personally present everywhere. So someone may have asked, well, he has connection with all material bodies as the Supersoul in everybody's body, in everybody's heart. Isn't it unavoidable that he'll be affected adversely by the inferior qualities of matter? Isn't he going to become contaminated and affected? This verse answers that. Yes, all bodies are part of his body. All the faces and other limbs belong to him. And he sits in everybody's heart. He's all-pervading. But he's Bhagavan. He avoids becoming affected, contaminated, because he possesses all power, all opulences. That's stated in the Vishnu Purana, description of the meaning of the word Bhagavan. And that word is here in this verse, third line, Sarvavyapisa Bhagavan. Jnana Shakti Balaishvarya Virya Tejamsa Sheshataha Bhagavat Shabda Vachyani Vina Heyayar Gunadibihi. That person who possesses in full the qualities, the opulences of knowledge, physical power, mental strength, influence over other people, potency of intelligence, in total, that person is called Bhagavan, who has these qualities, vina heya gunadibhi, without any inferior qualities. He's Bhagavan. So Bhagavan is free from all material contamination. He can sit in the heart of the living entity. He can sit anywhere he wants without becoming affected by the modes of nature. Thus, although he's all-pervading, he's not contaminated by Maya. Therefore, he can be called Shiva, all auspicious. This is echoed in the Bhagavad Gita. Anantavir yamita vikramas tvam sarvam samapnosi tatosi sarvaha. Arjuna praises Krishna, O unbounded power. You are the master of a limitless might. You are all-pervading, and thus you are everything. Okay. I think we can cover two more verses. Be back to where we are supposed to be. Verse 12. Mahan prabhur vai purushaha Tatvasyaisha pravartakaha sunirmalam imam shantim ishano jyotiravyayaha. The personality of Godhead is Mahaprabhu, Supreme Master. He initiates the perfect life of eternal perfection, the absolutely pure peace. He is the ultimate controller, the unfailing light, or source of light. This verse is quoted by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and Prabhupada gives it also in his purport in the third chapter of Adi Leela of Chaitanya Charitamrita as one of the Vedic evidences of the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But he's called Mahaprabhu here, Mahan Prabhu. This balances his being called Rudra and Shiva so many times. Bhaktivinoda Thakur cites many verses from Upanishads and other Vedic literatures which describe in concealed ways the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And this is one of them. He initiates the perfect life of eternal perfection, the absolutely pure peace. So the Supreme Person, seer of the mantras, the Rishi, Sreitashvatara, according to the one commentary, he has reached the level of success, that his intelligence has come to the level of attraction to Bhagavan. His intelligence is purified to the point that he's actually attracted to the Supreme Person. He's calling on Bhagavan, here he's calling on Mahaprabhu, and in a devotional mood glorifying him. This is not just some analytic description of an impersonal Supreme. Here he's remembering the Lord's mercy, and he's revealing something about his personal identity. He's the Purusha, which means he sits in the city, Pura, of the heart of each living being. He's the Supersoul. And even though he's locally present as a Supersoul, in one place, he's all-pervading at the same time. He's the greatest person, Mahan Prabhu. And he's capable, Prabhu means capable, able. He's able to give his favor, and he's able to punish also. He simply reciprocates. Now, he's not unfair or biased in this. He's simply reciprocating with all the jivas according to their individual karmas. He's the supreme master, the supreme autocrat. He's punishing some, awarding others, but it's simply in reaction, in reciprocation with their karmic activities. Now, why is he so capable? Because he's Ishana, the controller of everything. And he's the initiator of sattva, of pure existence, which can mean the world of goodness, or it can mean, sattva can mean the heart or the mind, the inner self. And why does he create the mode of goodness? Why does he create the mind? For the purpose of achieving the perfection of life. The mode of goodness and the mind are meant as instruments for achieving self-realization and devotional service. For the purpose of Sharanagati, of taking shelter of the Supreme Person. He's not a material controller, one who controls by force, like the element time. But he gives the living entities intelligence by which they can voluntarily surrender to him. He's Jyoti, the word is there, light, meaning that he's self-manifest. He's not created by anything else. He's not illuminated. He's not known by any other power. He creates himself and he reveals himself without any other help. And he's avyaya. He's infallible. He never comes to an end. The sun and the light of the sun have an ultimate end. But the Supreme Person is eternally luminous. He never comes to an end. And he's unchanging. He's unchanging in the sense that he's always attentive to the jiva's welfare. And he never gives up that quality. And one more verse, 13. Yes, please. If he knows what he's saying. I mean, someone can use the name Mahaprabhu and refer to and be referring to someone other than Lord Chaitanya. Mahaprabhu just means the supreme person, the ultimate literally. Maybe he knows. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur cites it as a description, an allusion to the appearance of Lord Chaitanya. So either he knew what he was saying, or he's saying, he's asked, something's coming out of his mouth that's beyond his own realization. 13.
Angushta matra purusho antaratma sadajananam vidaye sannivishtaha vidamanisha manasabi klipto yaitad vidur amitaste bhavanti.
This Supreme Person is the inner soul, always present in the hearts of all persons. There he appears in a form the size of one's thumb. He is realized by exercise of the heart, the intelligence, and the mind. Those who know him become immortal. Of course, that line, that last line, has been repeated several times. The second line has been repeated before, has been said before, that he's always present in the heart of all beings. And the third line has been stated once before, that he's realized by exercise of the heart, intelligence, and the mind. All these three lines are each repeated from different places. This is the means of gaining knowledge of him. He's thumb-sized because he hides himself in the heart, and he appears in the size of the heart. He's perceivable. He can be seen, even though he's hiding. There's a standard process for doing this. Rang Ramanuja, in the Sri Vaishnava commentary, he says that Vida, by the heart, means by devotional service, bhakti. And Manisha, by intelligence, means by perseverance, by steadfastness, determination. And Manasa means by fixing your mind, engaging your mind fully, making up your mind. These are the means of realizing the Lord. Devotion, determination, and conviction. Okay. Hare Krishna. Okay, that's about it anyway. Any questions? I can't see any hands, but speak up. Yeah. They're Gyanis who want something more. Yes. Lord in the heart, but also the creator of the world. And he's calling him Bhagawan, and he's describing something of his personal qualities. So yes, there's a big emphasis on the Lord in the heart. Prabhupada describes that, or Rupa Goswami describes, that the devotees in Shantaras are attracted to the super soul. Yeah, it's natural. Those who are beginning their devotional service in the mode of neutrality, they're especially attracted to the super soul. Super soul is an aspect of Bhagavan. Just like Brahman is a very distant realization of the personal, supreme person, when you can't appreciate any of his personal qualities. And Paramatma is when you have some partial, you're beginning to appreciate some of his personal qualities. Mostly, his qualities that reflect your life. You know, for you, the material world is important. The creation of that God created this material world for me, for my enjoyment, that's what's really important. And that he's sitting in my heart, that's the most important thing he does. The two most important things God does is create the world for me, and then he comes and sits in my heart That's a selfish, self-centered kind of God-realization. But it's at least some God-realization. It's immature. Krishna has much more important business than to create the material world for us and to come and sit in our heart. But it's partial. And so that's a supersoul. The supersoul is God working for us in the material world. Yes, if they're fortunate to have the guidance of someone who knows better, and they listen to that guidance, yes. Depends who they hear from, who they follow. Okay. Anything else? Okay, thanks. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.